to the study of the Constitution and civic responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The executive director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this program. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. It is a Wednesday. It is the 22nd day of January. And I know some of you are, this doesn't apply to, but most of you, I think it does. It's cold. And it's beautiful overhead, and with all this fresh snow on the ground, it's so clean and so quiet and so pretty. But it won't take but another day or two, and it's just going to be. And then you just want it to get. That's when it's, you know, we get puddles and all that. But it looks like we're going to have cold weather long enough that there's not going to be a whole lot of melt. So, but anyway, we will survive. We've done it before, and we'll do it again. And it is beautiful. And I think we constantly have to remind ourselves of that, because, you know, sometimes we become so busy that we just, everything that gets in the way and seems to be keeping us from what we believe to be our priorities is something we'd rather get out of the way. But when you think about it and you look at it, people that don't have it are really missing something. I keep telling myself that, hoping that eventually I'll believe it, but seriously. It is beautiful, and it is a wonderful day to be here at the Virtual Center with you. I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate your trust in sacrificing in some of your time, and I know it's valuable to a program like this. I appreciate it so very, very much. We do encourage you to give us a call and react to some of the issues that we're discussing here at the Virtual Center. We had a caller yesterday, if you remember. We had a call, Michael, and it was just one of the better calls we've gotten in a long time. It was just great, and I know that some of this information and some of the perspectives and are things that strike you in ways where you feel like you have something to say, but maybe you're not sure whether other people are going to feel the same way about it you do, or to think it's as important as you do. Let me ask you to not worry about that, because I've absolutely, in the 8 months or however long we've been doing the Virtual Center here, I can't remember one call we've made that wasn't more than worthwhile for people to hear. So don't even give it a second thought. We would love to hear from you. Our email address, our phone number is area code 304-658-3333. I'm jumping ahead to my email address first. But the phone number, that's what we're talking about, 304-658-3333. My email address, if you'd like to communicate with me directly, I would love to hear from you. My email is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906@gmail.com. One of the things that struck me after yesterday's program, I have the article by Anna Marie Cox, which is kind of what we looked at the close of the program yesterday, and we were looking at this article, let me just, as an aside, make a comment that one of the things that my association with something like the Virtual Center is doing, It is keeping me up on my reading. I'm reading an incredible amount, and I love it, and I always love to do it. And there's something unforgiving about a 2-hour program that's coming up in 2 or 3 hours or whatever. So even sometimes, if you'd like to say, I don't feel like reading today, fact of the matter is, once you get into it and once you do start to read, especially things that really excite the gray matter and cause you to think and react or whatever, good stuff, there's nothing like it. And I'm so appreciative of the opportunity to be here on a regular basis and to share these thoughts with you I have to keep pinching myself and telling myself that, you know, I must be careful to not convey the idea that everything that I say here during the two-hour period are things that I particularly agree with. I say that because I'm citing so much literature, not only related to the founders. We've done an awful lot of that, and of course we'll continue to do it. But some of the information that's coming out on some of the topics that we're dealing with that are indeed related to the whole issue of constitutionalism in America. And I'm citing this, that, and the other thing, and it doesn't necessarily follow that because I cite it, that means that I particularly endorse it or agree with it or anything else. In fact, quite the opposite. Much of the material that I want to share with you presents a position or an interpretation or a perspective that I may not necessarily agree with at all. And that's the point. Basically, I would suggest no way do I ever want this to this opportunity to deteriorate into a situation where all we're talking about is the same kinds of things with the same kind of perspective in order to reinforce things that we kind of believe going in anyway. I don't believe that. I find it to be extremely dangerous. When I hear people tell me that they don't watch anything else but Fox News, I shiver. But I do the same thing if people tell me the same kind of thing with something like MSNBC. In fact, if we could take the people that watch nothing but Fox News and ask them to watch MSNBC for a week and do it the other way around, I think the results might be very, very interesting. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen enough. People don't do that of their own free choice. And consequently, what we end up doing, too many of us, are reading the things that kind of go along with what we already believe. And what we're looking to do is reinforce things we already believe. And again, I think we have to confront points of view and issues that we don't necessarily agree with. And that's why I think, especially when we're dealing with history, going back looking at some of the primary sources, you know, I'm not going to make a decision or take a position and say, I don't agree with Thomas Jefferson or I don't agree with James Madison. I so respect the insight that these people bring to issues that whether, in fact, their position on a particular issue agrees with mine or not is not really the point. The point is, if you read enough and get to appreciate the range and the depth with which these guys read and thought, you can't do anything else but appreciate it. So again, I would love to hear from you. Again, area code 304-658-3333, and my email address waobrien906@gmail.com. Last evening, when the program was ended, as I started to say a few moments ago, one of the things that struck me, I mentioned that I'm trying to get through this book called Who Owns the Future, and we talked quite a bit about it yesterday. In fact, I took the Aristotle quote, if you remember, in our second hour yesterday, directly from that book. And one of the things that I neglected to mention, I'm only about not even a third of the way through the book. I would say probably 10-15%. And I hope to do quite a bit better. I'm going to be kind of snowed in for the rest of the week, along with a lot of you. So I'm hoping that I'll be able to get some time to do some serious reading and make some progress in this book, because I do think it is quite important. But one of the things that struck me about Lanier's book, And it's one of the comments he makes, and I can't remember exactly. If I could, I would go back and cite the page. That's one of the disadvantages of Kindle, it seems to me, is you're not dealing with the same page structure as you are in a hard copy of the book. And so you almost have to thumb your way, just go back page by page and hope that the thing jumps out at you. But anyway, one of the things that struck me last evening, and I had neglected to mention it when we were on the air, is the idea of those people just recognizing that while there are many, many people that are very, very concerned, obviously I'm one, about this threat to our privacy and security and the extent to which our inclination and willingness to give away so much information about ourselves, many times unknowingly. And again, I'm not criticizing anybody for that because in today's society, you almost can't do anything else. But the fact of the matter is, while there are many, many people who are very concerned about this, and I think we looked at a few, Ina Marie Cox and some of the other pieces of literature that we've looked at over the last couple of programs, but it's important to recognize that there are a lot of people, and many of them probably could be classified in the area of geeks, of people that are living in this revolution, this digital revolution that we're in the midst of, who are very, very supportive of it and trust it and believe in it. And it's important to recognize that that's true. There has traditionally been in our history, we have a history of people who have regularly believed, who regularly surface and believe that while science and technology create problems, a number of problems for our society at any particular point in time, the fact of the matter is many of the problems that technology causes, further technology can resolve. And many people have a tremendous faith in the fact that this is true and that this will happen. And what I'm saying is that many people who see the tremendous emphasis on information and the degree to which digital networking and all the things that we talked about yesterday are dependent on the quest for information from people whose privacy is being compromised, but in fact it's probably more than that, and that really concerns me too. But they believe very, very firmly that in the end all of this is going to work out for the better. And Lanier in his book makes reference to this very fact. And the fact that he has a background in Silicon Valley and he's worked with, and he's sold ideas to Google and some other of these large networking operations and organizations, he makes the point of saying that for a long time he was one of the supporters, and it was only after quite some time that he began to recognize the negatives of this. And he became very sensitive to it, and very concerned about it. And that's what prompts him to write this book. So in a sense, what makes the book valuable is not only the fact that he was on the inside, so to speak. He's got tremendous experience. He knows what he's talking about. He knows this business. He knows where these kinds of things came from and where they are headed and what the purpose is and all the rest of it. So he's speaking as an authority. And I think that's very, very important to keep in mind. It's very difficult not to take seriously some of the things that he says, because he's been there and he knows what he's talking about. And I think you recognize that very quickly. I did. And one of the things that he points out is that many of the people that he's worked with in Silicon Valley, many of the people that are totally, totally enthralled with the magic of technology and data collection and data manipulation really believe that ultimately the problems that it can solve will far outweigh the dangers that it seems to be causing in the short term. They believe that. And one of the things that I picked up on, I believe I did, I think I perceived it, and I thought it was so ironic, is that there's an element of Karl Marx that jumps out at you as you read this stuff. I meant to mention this yesterday and I didn't, but you know, better late than never, I guess. But if you remember just quickly about Marx's Communist Manifesto, Marx believed, of course, this is the idealism of Karl Marx. This is what critic Marx will constantly try to put to doubt, that Marx was so idealistic and unrealistic that what he's proposing actually couldn't happen. And some people are, in fact, so cynical, they basically will say, and Marx probably really knew that this was for public consumption, they believe. But what Marx predicted was, with the idea of the power of the state and the need for the state to eliminate all vestiges of competition and self-interest and all of that in society, to the point that you really turn society into a situation where everybody is looking at the same set of priorities, looking at the same goals, and agreeing, working together on implementing the strategies necessary to reach those goals. Marx's idealism, of course, is in the fact that ultimately, once this process has been completed, once all vestiges of self-interest and the profit motive and all of these things are eliminated, and once people's priorities have been focused on the right things, which is concern for the community and the idea that if the community prospers, we'll all prosper with it and all the rest of it. Marx basically argues that at that point, when there's no real need anymore for the state, and so consequently, at some point in the process, the state will wither away, and we will indeed have what Marx called a state of pure communism, where ultimately people, the ideal being that people can get along and live together because they all have the same priorities, and there's nobody involved that's trying to gain advantage over anybody else or anything else, that everybody would accept the idea that everybody has to be guaranteed enough to survive on and be comfortable on and have a meaningful quality of life and all of that. And once everybody agrees on that and is willing to work together towards achieving it, then Marx's argument is that there's really no need anymore for the state. It's extremely idealistic, and that's probably the basis of a lot of the criticism of Marx. In reality, you pick up that same idea in reading Lanier's book. It's very clear that many of these people that are involved, that are well placed in many of these digital networks, who are engaged in the process of data collection and data manipulation, they really believe that while there might be short-term problems and short-term negatives, in the long run, all of this is going to work out for the best, because at some point in time, there's not going to be any more need for, we'll have all we need to resolve all of our problems, and that ultimately we'll have reached nirvana, so to speak. And it's extremely idealistic, and it made perfect sense that people that are so into this process, into technology and what it can do, would probably believe just something like that. The idea that the very things that they are involved in are the solutions to the problems which we can't even define yet. And that ultimately they'll reach a point when not only do we have basically, a constant continuous flow of the information that we need in order to generate the so-called metadata, but technology will also have reached the point where these machines will have become so intelligent that they'll be able to see patterns and trends and things that we humans can't see, because there's just so much data there's no way in the world that the human mind can even conceptualize that we could handle that much information and organize it in the kind of ways that technology is going to make it possible for us to do. And rather than being something that is a tremendous threat, many of these people believe that this is a goal that we ought to strive to achieve. And the irony of the whole thing, to me, is the fact that it smacks of Marx. And if you said that to these people, they would be shocked. But in effect, that's what that's in many ways what they're talking about. And I think it's a fascinating idea. It's something that struck me as I was reading, and I kind of made a little note to myself, mental note to myself, to mention it, because I thought it was really interesting. And I haven't gone far enough in the book to be able to examine this in any more depth. So I don't know whether Lanier returns to this or not, but it's something that I've noticed early on in the book, in the very first part. I've gone about 3 or 4 chapters, I think, in the book, and it's one of the things that struck me as being potentially quite significant. Anyway, I have before me a copy of Anna Maria Cox's article that we closed yesterday's program with, and I just kind of wanted to touch on her conclusions again in order to kind of bring us back to where we were, so we can move on to yet another facet of this. And of course, what she's talking about is that there's evidence, there's a lot of evidence, that those people who are being asked are in many cases quite concerned about the fact that corporations, private entities are collecting and selling information about us, oftentimes without their permission. And I ask you to just note, and again, I'm not going to take any time on it, but I noticed this the other day. It occurred with me. Every once in a while, when you get a monthly bill from some organization or credit card company or something like that, there will be an insert in there where periodically these organizations send you their policy on privacy and information and what they do and what they feel that they have a right to exchange with others and pass on, and what they feel like they don't. And they try to do this to put customers at ease. But I would suggest to you that it's one of those things. It's usually a folded four-pager with print font that is so small that you almost need a microscope to read it. And when I see something like that, I become a little bit uncomfortable. But Anna Marie Cox makes the point that 71% of those polled, I think I mentioned this yesterday, say that they are very concerned about, quote, companies selling or sharing their information about them without their permission. But again, I think that one of the things that we touched upon yesterday, which I think is very significant, are the concluding comments that Anna Maria Cox makes about this whole process. And this is where we left the program yesterday, so I kind of wanted to return to it and pick up before we went on. She says citizens are supposed to be comforted by the data, comforted that the data is in some huge impersonal block of numbers. It's not data, it's metadata. And that's supposed to be, you know, that's a relief. The problem with mass data collection, she says, isn't that those who have it can find out about any one individual's private life. It's that if you have enough data, you don't have to find out about one individual's life. In other words, what you're looking for are ways to organize the data in such a way that you're finding common traits and you're grouping people with the same characteristics. And the only way to know that is to have access to this kind of data. So in a sense, what she's agreeing with is that most of these organizations aren't after your personal information, unless they're out there trying to steal your PIN numbers or something. But generally, most of these organizations aren't after your personal information. They could care less. But what they're after is the generation of the kinds of data that they get from you that they can share with data that they get from other people in order to find out basically what your priorities are, especially in terms of selling their product, whatever it happened to be. She says marketers have learned that more quickly than the government, in other words, the private collectors of data, are running way ahead of the government in terms of the realizations of some of these things. Foot dragging about do not track aside. Commercial interests don't want to know about you. They want to know about people like you. I think that's a beautiful sentence. It's a meaningful sentence. Says a lot. It's not you they're interested. It's finding out about people like you. One of the largest purveyors of consumer intelligence, BlueKai, has privacy protections that sound a lot like what President Obama outlined in his speech last Friday. They put a time limit on how long they track users. They keep all files anonymous. They also limit the data available in the profiles. No financial data, no health data, no sex or religious data. It's all converted into a form of metadata, which means numbers. Numbers, of course, can be manipulated and moved and all the rest of it. Their information, however, she says, is still incredibly valuable because the data they collect and distribute isn't intended to track a single person. It's intended to help marketers find a group of people who can be coaxed into sharing a single interest, their product. In other words, the single interest that they're looking for is the likelihood of being interested in the product that this organization seeks to sell. Massive amounts of data about millions of people allows commercial interests to sort users into categories, and then marketers can tailor the category's online experience to push its members as firmly as possible in the direction of its product. No one's privacy has been violated in the sense of having any secrets revealed. It's almost just the opposite. And as she points out, and I think this is very significant, this is the reason I wanted to go back to this today, and that's what makes this even worse than if they were pouring into your secrets. What the end result of this whole process is that we are being manipulated in a way that makes us less individual, less unique, less capable of having secrets to begin with. In other words, we are being dehumanized. The interest in us is being reduced to pieces of raw data, which are being included or interfaced with other people's data. And the sum total is, from the perspective of from the perspective that these operations, these organizations are functioning on, we don't exist as people. We exist as beings that can be enticed or directed or sold or encouraged or manipulated or whatever other word you might think is most appropriate. In other words, the end justifies the means. And the means is reducing all of us. So in a sense, and I'm citing, I don't want to go to it right now because I don't know if I can lay my hands on it. But Justice Louis Brandeis made the comment one time. He was talking about privacy. And he said, the right to be left alone is the essence of human honor and dignity. That's pretty close to a quote. I've read it a couple of times over the last 3 or 4 days. The right to be left alone is the essence of human honor and dignity. What he's basically saying is privacy is an incredible part, important part of our existence as human beings. And if we lose that, we cease to be functioning individuals. We cease to be human and we become almost automatons. And that seems to be, at least from Anna Marie Cox's perspective in this article, that seems to be the thing more than anything else that she's focusing in on. I'll be very honest with you. It also is what I focus in on. As we've talked many times, I'm not going to go into this at this point, but my whole background and educational experience has been in the liberal arts. And I've said numerous times on this program, and I mean it with very out being, that ultimately the real purpose of education, as I see it, is to learn the things that make us human. I don't believe the fact that we are alive and the fact that we are a breathing, moving, biological entity is what makes us human. What makes us human is what we learn about what being human means and why it is so distinct and so unique from other forms of life. And I really believe that. And that's why I wanted to go in as deeply as I have in the last couple of days into this topic, because I think the kinds of things that happen are happening to us in our society in large part as a result of the availability of the technology. It is giving organizations and institutions the opportunity to reduce us to functioning machines. And in the process, it is, I believe, dehumanizing us. And I believe that that's a real danger, and that's the reason that I've taken on this topic in such depth over the last 10 days or so. I believe it's incredibly important. I think one of the things I've found is the range of items and issues, the range of articles and comments and concerns that people have about what's happening are legion. In other words, it's amazing how many people are concerned about this. But I think it's important to put some flesh onto the bones of that concern. I think we have to take the time to be able to understand and explain and make our case as to why this is the danger that many of us superficially think it is. She says, Anna Maria Cox says, the masters of modern spycraft have learned from the masters of marketing the science of predicting human behavior. One of the main reasons for bulk collection, one that seems less alarming on its surface, is to watch for patterns of behavior that indicate possible terrorist activity. But when an organization is sufficiently skilled at predicting human behavior, the next phase, almost inevitably, is to try to influence it. And it is our marketing folks that have mastered the strategy of affecting, predicting, and ideally, from their perspective, controlling human behavior. So all the things that we grew up believing were so important, even though we couldn't define them and we couldn't explain them, things like free will and the right to choose and freedom, I've mentioned before that one of the things that amazed me during the Bush administration during the second Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, was the rather frequent yet rather flippant way that the president used the word freedom. You know, we're extending freedom, we're protecting freedom, we're making freedom possible for other people, we're expanding our freedom, we're doing this, that, and the other. And none of it was, but when you say freedom, for many, many people, that's all you need. As long as you're for that, then you can't be bad. And the fact of the matter is, it seems to me very, very important to think about and to reflect upon what we mean by freedom. What it is, you know, we are human beings. We have, I believe, we have a soul and a conscience and all the rest of it. So within all of this, it seems to me freedom needs to be defined. We have let the marketers define it for us. We have basically fallen into, I believe, the trap to assume that freedom is the same thing as free choice. And that ultimately there's nothing wrong with presenting the choices and then try to influence which choice we tend to go to. And I would suggest to you that one of the things I've learned in the years that I've been reading and appreciating history is that freedom means much more than the right to choose between alternatives presented by somebody else. Freedom ought to involve, should involve, the right to have some say in the choices. And I think that's the real issue. And so, in a sense, this is what we're talking about. And again, emphasis on the NSA and Edward Snowden and the extent to which government has itself has moved so openly and so rapidly and so overwhelmingly into the field of collecting and manipulating data is scaring a lot of people. But I think the issue here is that they're learning from the best. And that's what, in large part, is driving the economic engine that we call free enterprise. And I think we need to realize this. Basically, Anna Maria Cox links the collection of bulk data with the name of George Orwell. Probably don't have to worry about federal agents knocking down doors in the middle of the night. Tyranny can be a lot more insidious than that. It can be the limitation of options, the curbing of ambitions, or the gentle nudging forward down a path you thought you chose, but you really didn't choose it at all. I think that what she's got here is a very, very powerful. I think it raises some serious questions. And the reason I wanted to return to that piece today is because it leads in to what I think is a major portion of this subject, of this topic, that we have yet to really pursue in any depth. And that is the issue of the government itself, of the National Security Agency, and its collection of data. During his speech, how many times have we made reference to President Obama's speech last Friday on proposals to kind of rein in, at least in theory, the NSA. And as I mentioned yesterday, if you read the speech, one of the things that becomes very clear is that while he has some substantive and I believe significant recommendations in order to try to tone down and control what the NSA is doing, the fact of the matter is the one thing that seems to be off the table to the president is the collection of the data itself. It seems to me that Michael Hayden, in his prediction the day before the president delivered the speech, that the president's goal was not to do anything meaningful to interrupt or to regulate or minimize the NSA's access to data. Rather, it was to present a series of American people so that they would be much more comfortable with what the NSA is doing. And I think that's a very, very significant difference from reining in the NSA. This is an article that's dated January 17th, which I believe is the day after the president made his speech, about the president's speech. More specifically, about the president's opening comments in his speech, in which he went back into early American history. He was talking about surveillance, and he was talking about the long history that this nation has, as does every nation, in practicing surveillance. And specifically, he cites Paul Revere. And the president says, and this is directly from his speech, "At the dawn of our republic, a small secret surveillance committee born out of the Sons of Liberty was established in Boston. And the group's members included Paul Revere, America's early patriots." This happened. Absolutely no question.
Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
We'll be right back.